Good afternoon, and welcome to the Jewish Policy Center webinar. I am Shoshana Bryan, Senior Director of the JPC, and your host. I'm pleased to have so many of you here with us today. Thank you for joining us. I know you're planning to take off for the Independence Holiday, otherwise known around here as No King's Day. As the dust starts to settle after the really extraordinary raids on Iran by Israel and the United States, and as we wait to see who makes what move next and what it means, we're going to change our focus a little bit today. We at the JPC have long been supporters of the Kurdish people in the Middle East, in Iraq, in Turkey, in Syria, in Iran. They have been one of the most forward-thinking groups aligned with Western and Israeli interests. Unfortunately, they have been relegated to sort of second-tier American thinking and planning. Our guest today is retired American Brigadier General Ernie Audino. He's going to change that. He's been traveling in the region to the Kurdish areas. He's been talking to his Kurdish friends and counterparts, and he's going to bring us up to date. But before we get to Ernie, here is your JPC commercial. The Jewish Policy Center was founded in 1985 as a nonprofit organization providing analysis of foreign and domestic policies. We support a strong American defense capability, close U.S.-Israel security cooperation, and missile defense. Now, aside from our national security and foreign policy interests, the JPC advocates for small government, low taxes, free trade, fiscal responsibility, energy security, free speech, and intellectual diversity. That may make you think that we have a staff of like 72 people. No, we don't. But we try to get it all in there. Right now, given the limitations, our most important job remains to support the legitimacy and security of Israel and to support the efforts of the government of Israel and the IDF to defend the people and bring the perpetrators of the massacres, hostage taking, and rocket barrages to justice, and to bring the hostages, living and deceased, home. I know people are getting tired of the Gaza war. But I will say to you that no one is more tired of it than Israeli families that are sending their children, their parents, their siblings, their cousins to fight it. So we will keep doing our part. You can find our work on our website, jewishpolicycenter.org. That's jewishpolicycenter.org. There you can read our Insight articles, our magazine, In Focus Quarterly. Summer issue of In Focus Quarterly just posted. It is about the convergence of American and Israeli interests. And the convergence, unfortunately, of the threats to American and Israeli interests. You can also binge watch our webinar programs. That's jewishpolicycenter.org. And now, our guest, Brigadier General Ernie Audino, U.S. Army retired, currently serves as a senior advisor to the Gold Institute for International Strategy and senior advisor to the Kurdistan National Assembly. A West Point graduate, Ernie had a 28-year career serving in the armor, cavalry, infantry, and striker units. He was an Army Congressional Fellow at the U.S. Senate, Executive Assistant to the Vice Chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, and Director of Nuclear Support at the U.S. Defense Threat Reduction Agency. His last assignment was as Deputy Director of Operations for Headquarters, U.S. Army at the Pentagon. Now, Ernie will tell you, he does tell you, he will tell you. His most significant assignment was in Iraq, where he commanded a team of combat advisors embedded with the 3rd Infantry Brigade, 4th Division, Iraqi Army. His brigade was formed entirely of Kurdish Peshmerga guerrilla units, recommissioned to conduct counterinsurgency operations, which is what brought him to his longstanding advocacy for the Kurdish people and for their political aspirations. He's done a lot of other things, including running for Congress, including working with Congress people. But we're going to pay attention to the Kurds here. Ernie, in 2007, you wrote for In Focus Quarterly. People, you can find it on the website. You wrote, "It's not perfect Kurdistan, but the Kurds have accomplished in the north of Iraq much of what we had hoped for the rest of the country. They lifted themselves from the ashes of genocide. They subsequently established the most peaceful, the most democratic, the most industrious, the most moderate, Western-friendly portion of Iraq." Okay, that was a very hopeful moment. The article in Focus was hopeful. You were hopeful. Tell us where we are today. Tell us You've been there. You're looking at it. How are we doing? How are they doing?
Well, first, let me say, Shoshana, it's good to be back with you. I consider you a dear friend, and it's
Thank you.
always wonderful to chat with you. Thanks for this opportunity to chat today. Yeah, so I wrote that back then. Thanks for reminding me. And things have changed, of course. In many ways, they've gotten better. But in many ways, of course, there are those that are out there who oppose that. They oppose the progress that the Kurds have been making. We'll get into that a little bit. The Kurds still have what I've said before in other forums, this desire to make today better than yesterday and tomorrow better than today. And why is it? They have seen some of the worst that humanity can dish out. Humanity, put that in quotation marks, right? So under Saddam Hussein, they were hit with chemical weapons 48 times, at least that we know about. 46 of those strikes were in my base area inside Iraqi Kurdistan, the Kurdish north of Iraq. And Saddam Hussein had these, what did he call them? New Saddam villages. Yeah, they were the new Saddam villages. They were really the Iraqi version of concentration camps for Kurds. The with his cousin, Ali Hassan Majid, who later went on to earn his nickname, Chemical Ali, they designated an entire swath along the Iranian border as, quote, the forbidden zone. No animal, no human being, and certainly no Kurd could exist within it. All of those people were uprooted. And basically, the way Saddam did it is, I don't know, 4,600, 5,000 or so villages were identified on military maps as objectives. They were encircled by Iraqi forces. Artillery would fall in the village. And as the villagers were, of course, running out of the villages, they were scooped up in these Iraqi military cordons and then moved into the Saddam villages. The Saddam villages were concentration camps patrolled by Iraqi military and Mukhabarat. And they're still there today. Dilapidated, thank goodness, and really no one lives there now. But they're there, and I must have had half a dozen of those all within a 30-minute drive of my safe house. Halabja, the site of the world's largest chemical strike against civilians, 16 March 1988. 5,000 Kurds died that day. I had friends who were there as the chemical weapons were falling, nerve agents, blood agents, blister agents. Many thousand more were maimed. That was a half an hour drive from my concentration or my safe house. Anyway, the Kurds have seen the worst. So when Al-Qaeda and ISIS popped up on the map, they were going to have none of that. They absolutely opposed that. And the fact of the matter is, I'll illustrate one point here with an ISIS example. The black flag of ISIS. When ISIS popped up in 2014 up around Mosul and surged through Iraq through largely the Sunni areas, it nearly split Iraq in two. It came within 60 miles or so of the Iranian border in a town called Jalala. When the Iraqi army collapsed and ran away from this, the Kurds had stepped forward, stopped ISIS along a forward edge of the battlefield about 1,000 kilometers long, and in Jalala stopped them there. Otherwise, Iraq would have been split in two. And the black flag of ISIS since then has never flown on a single inch of Kurdish-controlled territory. Never. So the subsequent war against ISIS, largely enabled, of course, by the United States and some of our allies, but the Kurds were the main effort in that fight, and I call it the fight to defend humanity. We couldn't have done it without them. There was no fight against ISIS without the Kurds. So today, the Kurdish region of Iraq has been building on that, modernizing in all sorts of ways. I mean, when I was there, there was no such thing as electronic banking, for crying out loud, So when the Peshmerga were paid, they had to be paid in cash. And that sounds simple, but when you're deployed on the battlefield, how do you get your cash back to your family? You know, simple can be very difficult, and it's little things like that. You know, there's no such thing as health insurance or car insurance, but these things now are starting to fall into place for the Kurds. If you go to Erbil now, it's glittering. There's so much building going on. I brought a philanthropist friend with me to Erbil in my last visit last month, and he wanted to award scholarships to two student athletes, scholar athletes, high school age. He was so impressed when he got there. He awarded three, and they'll be coming to the United States, hopefully after the visa application process runs. But they'll come here to study for at his elite academy here in Florida. But he turned to me numerous times to tell me he never expected what he saw there in Erbil, the amount of construction that was going on. And by the way, Shoshana, that's still in the face of Iran's attempts to shut all of this down. We can get into that later.
Yeah, maybe we should do that right now, actually, because I know there's tremendous interest in our audience and things that Iran does. And we tend to think of Iran as the big threat to Israel and sits there and threatens the United States. And the Israelis and the United States together have taken care of a piece of it. But I don't think that we understand properly the threat that Iran poses to Kurds, both the Kurds inside Iran and the Kurds outside. So let's move on, maybe a little faster than I thought we would, but let's move on to Iran and tell us what's going on there, or what's going on with the Kurds anyway.
Okay, well, let's see. So I'm going to have to back up a little bit. Kurdistan, like Israel, is seen as almost a little piece of the Western world inside maybe the Dar al-Islam. And Tehran cannot stand. The regime cannot stand this progress that's been occurring beneath their noses, so to speak. When Barack Obama withdrew U.S. combat power from Iraq in December of 2011, just as nature abhors a vacuum, so does national security and foreign policy, Iran surged into Iraq, immediately co-opted the southern 60% of Iraq, which was comprised of the co-religionists to Tehran. The Shia community is largely down there in the southern 60% of Iraq. Took over most of the ministries, took over the Iraqi security forces, and then, well, by 2017, none less than Qasem Soleimani boasted that the Iraq, quote, the Iraqi army is now a Hezbollah army, unquote. Okay. Baghdad, under the new Iraqi constitution, which is really a pretty good document, I must say, Baghdad is committed, obligated to provide a share of the federal revenues to all of the regions based on a certain the demographics of the region. We can quibble about 1%, 2% here or there, but it's kind of close. The Kurds are supposed to get 17% of federal revenues. They've never gotten it. Baghdad's never sent it to them. Most of the time, it's been zero. It's at zero right now, by the way. So the Kurds in 20, I don't know, maybe, let's just say 2010, began to export their oil. The Kurds sit atop one third of all of the oil in Iraq, and Iraq is second in OPEC only to Saudi Arabia in terms of its reserves, began exporting its oil out, not south, north through the Turkish port of Ceyhan. It really was brilliant. Oil was discovered, commercial oil was discovered in the Kurdish part of Iraq in the early 20s, and that began Baghdad's attempts to Arabize those areas of Kurdistan, ethnically cleanse them of Kurds. It's continued until Saddam's time. Anyway, the Kurds have never been able to enjoy their oil resources. But let's say 2010, they decided they had to. They were getting no revenues from the federal government, zero. They were really not even considered citizens, for crying out loud. And so they started exporting oil, and life got so much better inside Iraqi Kurdistan. And they got stronger. And Tehran decided to choke off the oxygen to the Kurds diplomatically, militarily, and economically. And over time, every time an opportunity was presented, it happened. In 20, the last, let's say, 4 years or so, Baghdad, the back Tehran's proxies in Baghdad sued in the International Arbitration Court, sued Turkey, because Turkey was receiving this Kurdish oil. And unbelievably, the arbitration court ruled that a Saddam-era agreement between Baghdad and Ankara prevented use of the Iraqi-Turkish pipeline unless Baghdad was getting money off that pipeline. So the
Wow.
Turks shut it down. This was Kurdish oil that was going through it. It wasn't Iraqi oil. But they shut it down. It hasn't been reopened. So economically, that lifeline has been shut down to the Kurds. In 2017, during the Kurdish referendum on independence, a non-binding referendum, non-binding, simple question to the Iraqi Kurds: would you like to someday become an independent nation? A legitimate question. And by the way, a question that was extended to the so-called disputed areas, those areas that were historically Kurdish, taken over by Saddam Hussein and never returned. That question was extended to those people there too, which included some mixed ethnicities. What was the result? 93% said, yes, we want to see a sovereign Kurdish independent state. When that happened, Tehran surged in with its proxies, seized most of the disputed areas, was barreling down on Erbil. Thank goodness they got stopped. The proxies still began to control some of those areas and disputed areas. So militarily, Tehran has been applying its levers over Erbil, the Kurdish capital, ever since. Economically, it's been choking off the oil. And diplomatically, it's got a stranglehold on the Iraqi parliament. So it's difficult to get any legislation passed inside Iraq that could benefit the Kurds. Now, we can go many places with this, but you got to ask the question, all right, why should we do anything for the Kurds? And if the answer, go ahead.
Before we get to that question, because that's a big question and I want to go there, you would think, or I would anyway, that when the Kurds were sending oil north through Turkey, the Turks were obviously being paid as people get paid for shipping oil and all that sort of stuff. Did the Turks have nothing to say when the Iraqis cut the shipments? Do they just say,
Well, in a
okay, fine,
way,
we don't care?
Ankara did have something to say. Ankara
Okay.
said, you still have a second lawsuit against us. You're trying to get another $2 billion out of us. You're not going to get that. We're not going to ship any oil. You're going to get nothing. So that was Ankara's position. Yeah.
Okay, so now we know that Turkey is not, or wasn't in that context, going to be helpful to the Kurds. And on the other side, I think we need to understand better. There is a Kurdish population in Iran that is connected to that Kurdish population that's in Iraqi Kurdistan, right? So
Right.
we're talking about the Iranians rolled through their own Kurds and then into Iraq to the Iraqi Kurds. Did anything about this referendum include Iranian Kurds, or was that strictly an Iraqi Kurdish measure?
Strictly an Iraqi Kurdish matter.
Okay. So the Iranians couldn't say, well, you're trying to undermine Iran, right? It was separate from that. I mean,
They
they'll
said
say it anyway. Okay,
that.
fine.
They said
You know they're going to say it anyway. But
that.
it wasn't designed to get Iranian Kurds involved in the process, right? It was designed for Iraqi
You know,
Kurds.
let me say one thing though, Shoshana, on the referendum. A similar referendum was held in 2005, by the way. And Iran didn't act then the way it did in 2017. The referendum that was held in the Kurdish region of Iraq was the same basic question. And this one, though, was extended not to the disputed territories. It was just the recognized Kurdish areas. So presumably 100% Kurdish, right?
Right.
The referendum came back 97%. Yes, we want a Kurdish independent nation. But guess what? Iran didn't attack. The proxies didn't attack. Nothing happened. Now, why would that be? Because the United States
That's
government
right.
was still on the ground.
Yeah. So our presence had something to do with it. I have to think also that the Iranians weren't happy about any of those, either of those referendums. The Turks and the Syrians couldn't have been happy about them either, since, and again, something that we need to emphasize here, Kurdish population of Turkey, Kurdish population of Syria. I would assume that no matter what the Kurds do for themselves, the Iraqi Kurds, it will be seen as a threat by those other countries. Maybe the stoking of revolution among Kurds in their countries. Is this another reason that they didn't want to help?
Yeah, that's the prevailing opinion in Turkey, sure, But the Kurdish regional government in Iraq is not unaware of that. And the Erbil has been working to build a rapport with Ankara. It really has much improved relations, and the oil deal was brilliant because everybody on both sides of that border benefited from the flow of that oil. Ankara
Right.
made a buck, and so did Erbil. So they were both motivated to keep that flowing. So that was a unifier.
Okay. So now we get to. So we were not on the ground, and we were not in a position to be helpful. And so what happened after the. So have they been in a kind of holding pattern since that referendum and since we've left? Is there any change in their international situation or their internal situation? It seems to me that an awful lot of Iraqis, non-Kurdish Iraqis, have gotten tired of Iran's meddling in their country in the meantime. Does that help the Kurds?
Yeah, that's a great question. In a way, the situation with the choking off of the oxygen to Erbil, that hasn't changed. That remains. And since the strikes inside Iran, Operation Rising Lion and Operation Midnight Hammer, brilliantly executed. Yes. Superb, superb. We need more of that. Bring that on. Ironically, the opinion on the street inside Kurdistan is maybe things are going to get worse for us right now.
Oh, explain that, please.
Yes. Now, look, quietly, they were all loving this. They just think we stopped too soon. Okay. Quietly, they're loving this. The problem is the Iraqi government right now, the Iranian co-opted Iraqi government seems to be doubling down on the pressure. Seems to be absolutely unwilling to get into any discussions of providing federal revenues to the Kurdish region of Iraq. So that's a concern. And just in over the last, let's say, couple of years, Iran has been increasing its drone, rocket, and at one time ballistic missile attacks inside the Kurdistan region of Iraq. And the average guy on the street, look, it's an obvious question. What has this closer relationship with the United States gotten us? In the last few years, it's gotten us a bunch of rocket strikes and drone strikes. So there was a risk, being timid hasn't helped anything. And I'm sorry, this is the price of timidity on our part.
Whose timidity? Whose
Ours,
being?
yeah,
Ours.
ours, yeah.
So, okay, so we're not, clearly, we were not timid on the issue of the nuclear facilities. Timidity, as in, we're not willing to support our friends on the ground in other times and other places. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, but I
What
would
could we
all.
do? What could we do to help the Kurds? If I said to you, all right, I'm the president. No, I don't want to be the president. but I have some ability to run things. And I want to make life better for the Kurds because I do. What can I do for them?
Let me turn that around a little bit. When you ask it that way, people real it's a humanitarian question. Let's do this for humanitarian reasons. As
Okay.
supremely important as humanitarian reasons are, people get tired of hearing that.
For sure.
You know, they get tired of hearing, oh, let's go help the Kurds, or let's go help this group or that group. We get tired of it, sadly, but we do. Rather, we need to articulate our vital national interests. And where they coincide with a group like the Kurds, we need to loudly and proudly promote that, secure that, defend that. And I run around saying there's five or six vital national interests that all coincide straight through Kurdistan.
Let's have it.
Well, you absolutely. One, the defeat of jihadi groups on the ground. They're still running around. ISIS is still running around, and militarily has been quite disrupted, but it's still there. All right. So the defeat of jihadi extremist organizations on the ground. Two, the defeat of jihadi ideology, a much longer term endeavor, let's say, and not something that the Western world is going to have a real say in it. This is a debate within Islam. But the moderate voices inside Islam, which the Kurds are, they speak, they have a chance of carrying that argument, and therefore that deserves some support and defense and promotion by the Western world, United States here. Three, the promotion of democracy. I am not saying nation building. I am not. But the promotion of democracy, absolutely. You know, the only other real democracy there is in Israel. Okay. So if we have a democratic Kurdish state someday, the amount of democracies in the Middle East doubles. It goes up by 100%.
Yeah, it does.
And democracies don't go to war with other democracies. We fight it out in the marketplace of ideas, you know. Four, a check on Iranian ambitions. And as I said earlier, Iran surged in December of 2011, and things have not been the same. So you would think reestablishing a favorable balance of power vis-a-vis Iran would be in our interest. But that is done by checking Iranian ambitions and not accommodating them, not apologizing for them. Five, a ready access to energy, as unseemly as that sounds. You know, it's kind of the basis for the world economy, and everything depends on that. And we have a dependency there. The Western economy has a dependency on that. Ready access to oil. Tehran wants to choke all of that off. China wants to choke all of that off, by the way. China's importing 90% of Iraqi of Iranian oil, and through the Chinese National Petroleum Company, is trying to gain gobble up stakes, oil stakes inside Iraq as we speak. They're trying to do that. And here's the last one. Here's the last one. A non-nuclear Iran. Right? We can't dispute that one. So all of those, the Kurdish region is connected with all of those. It's the last piece of terrain, open and welcome to a counterbalance to Iranian ambitions in the area.
So basically, what you're saying is that an alliance or a cooperative arrangement or assistance or whatever between the United States and Iraqi Kurds, and perhaps later Iranian Kurds or Syrian Kurds, I'm going to get to Syrian Kurds in a second, is not a humanitarian gesture, although it has that impact, but it's a strategically useful thing for the United States.
100%.
So this is about our interests, not just feeding people on the ground, which is nice, but this is bigger. I think a lot of people were not, a lot of, there's a lot of time spent on China's interest in Iranian oil and why the Chinese are opposed to Iran blocking the Straits of Hormuz because they will be blocked. But the thing about China wanting to be in Iraq's oil production and movement capability. I think this is not well understood. And I wonder if the beginning of that could be to get American companies to invest in Iraq. Now, I'd like to see them in Iraqi Kurdistan, but the beginning, perhaps. If it's true that the Iraqis are not happy with the arrangement with Iran, could that be a beginning of a way to wean them from Iranian control? Or
A fair
not?
question. I still think identity means a lot in that area. And you've got, 60% of the population in Iraq is Shia. I think that's going to be a hard identity with Tehran. That's going to be a hard one to crack.
Although they're Arabs, not Persians. I mean, you've got two sets of identities among the Iraqis. Iraqi Shiites are Arab Shiites, and Persian Shiites are Persian Shiites.
Yeah, but Tehran, through its Hashd al-Shaabi, has lots of muscle on the ground amongst the Shia communities. Muqtada al-Sadr, for example, and the Jaish al-Mahdi, those are all Iraqi Shia, but they cause us a lot of trouble, right? And
Indeed.
every time Baghdad may begin to consider even some legislation that might stray from the Iranian desires. What happens? You see these violent protests that erupt inside Baghdad. So that's Tehran's way of showing the parliamentarians there in Iraq, hey, we still have the muscle.
Does this lead us to the need for regime change in Iran? Now we've watched, and I will say that we specifically here at the JPC, because we've been watching the Gaza war, we watched Israel decimate Hezbollah. We watched them do a lot of bad things to Hamas, not enough bad things, but they're getting there. Syria, they made it possible for the Syrians to change their government. Is it At the end of the day, do we need for Iran to change its government? Is all the rest of this just playing around the edges?
I will say, yes, it's in our interest to see this regime, this threat regime in Tehran, collapse. Now, before anyone says Aldino is arguing for nation building, I'm
I
not.
would never say that.
And I know you wouldn't say that. I draw a distinction between nation building and destroying a threat regime. I'm all about destroying a threat regime. If it is a threat to the United States, you better buckle your seatbelts because you're going to be in for a rough ride. Nation building is another matter because I don't presume that I'm the smartest guy in the room and I should be able to tell Iranians what government is best for them. I may have an opinion, but in the end, it's up to them. Yes, the collapse of this threat regime in Tehran would be in U.S. interest. And I happen to, let's look at it. Israel did not expressly identify an objective of regime change, but they named their Operation Rising Lion for a reason. It's a direct reference to the pre-Islamic night, pre-1979 Iranian flag, which had the lion, the sun, and the sword on it. Incidentally, that sun has 21 rays that traces to its Zoroastrian roots. And it's the same 21 rays you see on the Kurdish flag. Oh,
Really?
yes. But nevertheless, rising line. And why did Israel do that? Because they, if it wasn't an express objective, they weren't ignorant of the potential for that to happen as a second or third order effect. I have an acquaintance, a buddy who actually participated in the little known 1981 Noge coup d'etat to overthrow the Ayatollah Khomeini. He was an F-14 pilot for the Shah. And he was here in the United States studying in 1979. And of course, we know everything happened in 1979. And he's only been back to Iran once since then, and that was as part of the coup. He was recruited to go in. And unfortunately, the coup was compromised and aborted. Very few of these men got out. He happened to get out. But I was chatting with him and I had a suspicion. I said, what was the trigger? Now, you guys were hoping for an uprising. What was the planned trigger to motivate the uprising? And he said, we needed to see serious indicators that the regime was losing its ability to control. And I submit to you today, Shoshana, that was likely a hoped-for condition of Operation Rising Lion. I think that if that condition arose, we would have seen more motivation amongst Iranians to rise up.
Yes, I think it's very clear. The Israelis struck the Basiji guards. That has nothing to do with Israel. They attacked the internal security police. They attacked the communications among the various internal police and control mechanisms. I mean, they did a lot of things. The bombing of Evin prison, none of those things
Yes.
have anything to do with the security of Israel. They were designed, it seems to me, to tell the Iranian people, this is your moment. Now, I know that those moments can unroll over time. It would be foolish, naive to think that they're going to rise up the week after and say, okay, we're ready to do this. But one can hope that those things and the taking out of those capabilities will encourage the Iranian people to think that this is their moment, because I don't know how many more moments they get, frankly.
That's a great point. How many more moments do they have? You're right. But you know, I'm going to put it this way. Winston Churchill urged us not to take counsel of our fears.
It did.
Unfortunately, we still have lots of, I call them herbivores in our society. And yeah, they'll run around and they will say, yeah, you know, but the day after could be worse.
True.
Sure, I understand your concern, but let me ask you this question. Worse than a nuclear Ayatollah?
I would think that Americans today, and the polls indicate that this is true, Americans do favor what President Trump did to the Iranian nuclear sites. I think we get that. Whatever he chose to do, whatever the result of what he chose to do, it was going to be better than having a nuclear Ayatollah. So I think we get that. I think it's harder for the Iranian people who live in Tehran, who know exactly what the downside of upsetting an Ayatollah is, to say, well, what's worse than what I have? I'll tell you what's worse than what I have. They come to my house and they drag off my husband and cut his head out. Oh, that's worse. So there's a difference, I think, between how we see those things here in the safety and security of our space and how they see them. So I am not sure they're going to rise up. I think they have a different calculus. I hope they rise up. And when they do, then I hope we can support them, which is going to lead me to north. We're going to go west and whatever. We're going to go to Syria. They've had regime change in Syria, and it seems to me that the regime change in Syria will have an impact on the Kurds, as well as the decision by the PKK to disarm itself. So, do you want to start with the PKK and talk to us about why they chose to do that and why now? And then I'm going to ask you a little bit about Syria. I know you weren't in Syria with your travels, but we're going to try to
Yeah.
get there.
Well, it's true. Abdullah Öcalan, who founded the PKK in Turkey in the 80s, as I recall, has been waging his insurgency against the government in Turkey ever since. And it's kind of been a double-edged sword for the Kurds. Right? Bit of a double-edged sword, and folks on the street will say that to you. But Öcalan from prison, he's in prison now, just in the last 2 months, announced that the PKK would lay down its arms. Tremendous, tremendous. It was received quite well across the Kurdish areas. I never expected, however, that any of the Kurds in Syria would feel the need to abide by Öcalan's decision. And I think that was the case because they were still battling for their own survival against the remnants of ISIS over there and against a regime in Damascus that was now headed by a gentleman named Jolani, the HTS government. He now goes by the name Sharaa, got it. But can a leopard really change its spots? Time will tell. We will see. So The YPG, the Kurdish fighters in Iraq, comprise the majority of the Syrian Democratic Forces, the SDF. Those are the folks we've allied with inside Iraq. It's the Kurdish-led SDF that has really put the wood screws to ISIS and on the ground in Syria. They again were the main effort in this fight. We still have Americans embedded with them, and we have a great relationship with the SDF. Ankara doesn't like that because Ankara considers the SDF, the YPG, to be a branch of the PKK. I accept that they have a difference of opinion, and I actually think that's a minor point, frankly. The fact of the matter is, the Kurds in Syria control at least a third of the country, if not more. Certainly,
Really?
all the way to the Euphrates and some of the airports. And by the way, they have always held leverage over Damascus since the Assad regime fell. And what would that be? The Kurds sit atop the vast majority of the oil-producing regions inside Syria. And so, notice the Syrian forces rarely attacked the Kurds inside Syria because otherwise the Kurds would shut off any oil supplies. To this day, that's right. To this day, a recent deal has formally been inked, I understand, with the last couple of months with the new government. We'll keep supplying you some oil. And I don't know what the specific promises were, but the Kurds still sit atop all that oil. They still sit atop at least one airport in Hasaka, as I recall, in the northeast. So they could shut that down. The problem for them, though, is how to get it out of the country. If you can't ship it west towards the eastern Mediterranean to the ports there, what do you do? Well, there are pipelines that head northeast. I don't know if they're used, but they head northeast to the Fishkabur crossing into Iraq, the Kurdish portion of Iraq. So there's potential there, Shoshana.
But that would put it in the hands of Iran, essentially, right? If you ship it to Iraq
Well,
and.
no, the Kurdish control part of Iraq.
Okay, and so how do the Kurds in the Kurdish controlled area get the oil out of there? So you
Yeah,
could
that.
ship it maybe back to Turkey. I mean, maybe you create a new pipeline and get it to Turkey. No
I think,
pipelines from Syria to Turkey?
not that I know of, but I'm going to guess that's probably in the planning phase somewhere. I would think they're going to need something from that northeast corner that either opens up into the Kurdish region of Iraq or goes straight up into Turkey, because that's where three borders meet, right there at Fishkabur.
What would happen if you were an optimist? I was an optimist. And you tried to send the oil west, either to a Lebanese port or to Haifa port. Could you do that?
I suppose you could. It's being trucked right now. I think if it's 5,000 barrels a day is being trucked towards Damascus, I'm sure it could be trucked down towards Haifa or Lebanese ports. But trucking is really economically not tenable over time. You need a pipeline to do it economically.
And then you need relations in order to get the pipeline. Turkey had been sending oil, shipping oil, down the Mediterranean to Israeli ports, and Israel was then trucking it overland to Jordan. I mean, there are ways to circumvent, even though Turkey would probably never admit that kind of relationship with Israel. It wanted to get the oil to Jordan, and so they did it. But it seems to me that if you could solve some of those logistical problems, you could also create a mechanism whereby the countries of the region would have a much more profitable future for everybody.
Exactly.
So we could be optimists for a minute. I usually get to the optimist part at the end of the program. I think I just killed the end of my program because we got hit here. But tell me then what you're seeing of the Kurds in Syria is that the PKK disarming in Turkey is good for them. Because it makes them less scary to the new Syrian government. But the fact that the Syrian government is run by a guy who used to be, he claims he left ISIS, but Maybe he did and maybe he didn't. We'll have to be skeptics on that one. So maybe the relations between the Syrian government and the Kurds can move forward in a positive way. And you're right, the Syrian government wasn't attacking the Kurds, it was attacking the Druze. And that's a problem for Israel because Israel has a very large Druze population, which is comprised of very loyal citizens. And they have good connections, close connections to the Druze in Syria. So we've got to figure out how to make sure that al-Shara, or al-Jolani if he prefers, doesn't let the Kurds live relatively quietly because they're oil, but take it out on the Druze at the southern part of the country.
Right. No, exactly. No. Well, here's some of the good stuff.
Good, we
Erbil.
need good stuff.
Yeah, I mean, General Maslum, who leads the SDF, Maslum Abdi, Kurdish, Syrian Kurdish, for years has not had a really good relationship with Erbil, and that is improving.
Oh.
That is improving. General Maslum and the Kurdish Prime Minister, Masrur Barzani, have had talks, very good talks. And it hasn't stopped with just the Prime Minister. President Netjervan Barzani has had talks. They're in communication with even the big guy, Masoud Barzani, the son of the great Kurdish nationalist,
Right.
Mustafa Barzani. Who passed away in 1979, by the way. But nevertheless, these things would have been unthinkable a couple of years ago, but now they're talking and they know they've got to work together. So we'll see where this goes, but they've begun to talk.
So it seems to me that all of those little pieces could come together in a very, very nice way and could produce a much better region for everybody. But do they need a superpower patron? Now, I know Turkey wants to have its hand in everything in that part of the world. It's not a superpower. It's not. Iran is not a superpower, although it also would like to control everything. Does the United States have to figure out how to get in there? And I totally agree with you. Nation building, democracy promotion, none of that is not for us to do. But do we need to be a patron? Do we need to be an overarching presence so that things don't devolve? And can we be?
Yeah, I mean, great nations have been doing that kind of thing for, since dirt was invented, right? But even Marco Rubio, I mean, I got to give him some credit. Just a couple of months ago, within a month, maybe it was a month ago, he made this statement about Baghdad. He said, "Look, Baghdad is trying to establish closer relationships with the United States right now." But it is, if that's going to happen, it is founded on two things: Baghdad's respect for the international oil companies that are operating on Iraqi soil, and get this, Shoshana, respect for Kurdish autonomy.
Wow.
Holy cow. Where was
Is that
this coming from? All right. We would never have allowed ourselves to say that some time ago, even though the consulate we built in Erbil is I think it's the largest consulate in the world. Why would you build a consulate so large? Because really, maybe in the back of your mind, you thought, it could be an embassy someday.
So that statement got very little play, the Rubio statement, which is a shame because none of the stuff having to do with the Kurds gets a lot of play. We have been fixated, it seems to me, on Iran, and we're fixated on Israel and Gaza, and that is, it's extremely important to Israel, and it's extremely important to the people of Gaza and the people who support Hamas. But it's a very small piece of the world. It's a very small piece of the region. I worry that we get much too narrowly focused and forget what our larger interests are.
It's natural, I think, though, that we do focus on Iran because, all right, from a military perspective, we look for the centers of gravity in amongst our adversaries. What is that thing that enables their offensive movement, right? What is that thing that keeps them fighting? And, in the days of Alexander, when you pretty much had, if you defeated the army, you won the war. Right. So the army itself was the center of gravity. If you've got a a tottering regime, or if you've got a nation or a country experiencing lots of internal instability, well, the center of gravity historically generally is that regime itself. You topple that regime. If you've got indigenous groups or irregular groups operating inside other countries and they have a foreign patron, their center of gravity is that foreign patron. Okay? You destroy that foreign patron, and you're going to drastically undermine those far-flung foreign irregular forces from any future meaningful military operations. But then, then again, in a democracy, it's hard to argue anything other than our domestic support is our center of gravity, right? You undermine our domestic support, and there's very little we're going to be able to continue to do militarily. And that's why you see so many terrorist strikes against non-combatants. This is an attempt to undermine U.S. support for our operations, to affect the will of Americans. This is why you see people like Vladimir Putin. Every week he's shaking the nuclear sword. He's rattling that sword. Well, what is he hasn't done anything. He's playing a game on Americans, trying to undermine our support for toughness and spine in the face of these ambitions.
So until last week, excuse me, until last week, I might have thought that he was winning that game, waving the sword, and we were not prepared to move forward in a big way. But I wonder if that's over for the moment. The US attacks in Iran and the lack of Chinese response and the lack of Russian response, it seems to me, makes them look weak. It makes them look as though. And it's true. What could they have done? What could the Chinese have done? Nothing. There was nothing for them to do. And so they did nothing. And the Russians did nothing. So I wonder if US resolve didn't get a little bit of a of an upgrade here over this. We did it with zero casualties, zero boots on the ground, zero retaliation, all the things that President Trump had said that we were going to do. So maybe we're in a better position now. I'm going to go back to my optimistic side. We're going to have an additional bit of resolve that we can play for somebody. And maybe if we're lucky, or the Kurds are lucky, maybe we'll play it for them. The Syrians are interested in what we have to say to them. And so, how Syria deals with its own Kurds, and how the Syrian Kurds deal with Iraqi Kurds, and what Turkey does here, we may have a little bit more leverage than we had before. I'm going to hope we do. What do you think? Are we in a better spot?
I think we are definitely in a better spot, especially with the administration we have now. But keep in mind that the domestic support, our center of gravity, for maintaining our spine to act forcefully, resolutely, depends on the domestic support. But that is a measure of the value of the objective. So every time the objective changes, whatever this new thing is, our president has a duty, the duty, to help the rest of us knuckleheads understand why this objective, doing something to secure it or promote it, is valuable, has stakes inside the United States. So it's the, Clausewitz wrote this, the most influential theorist on warfare in the Western Hemisphere. Karl von Clausewitz wrote, it's the value of the objective that determines the magnitude and the duration of any war any nation will wage in its pursuit. I assert that just that goes beyond war too, to any major human endeavor. I mean, it's irrational if it's a low value objective. Why do you commit massive amounts of blood and treasure? It doesn't make sense, right? So that pre the president's got to come out. He has to convince us why whatever this next objective is so valuable that we're ready to commit serious U.S. Resources to secure it. And in this case, talk about the courage, talk about our vital national interests, talk about how they're put at risk.
That makes sense. So it's a multi-pronged effort. We have to be militarily prepared to do what we say we're going to do, but we also have to be prepared to convince the people to go with us. Unlike some countries where they don't have to, where the leader says, "I'm going to go do this," and he goes and does it. We have a more complicated system. And I like it. And it's a good way to think about going out before Independence Day, or as we say here, No King's Day. It's important to know that we have no kings, that our president has to convince us. And that's a good thing. So, Ernie, as we close, I just want to say to you, as a member of the United States military, we celebrate the 4th of July with great gratitude for all the things you guys have done from the beginning, all the way through the Iraq War, and all the way through and up to the Iran bombing. We have nothing but respect and admiration for you guys and the way you allow us to live in this country. So thank you. I thank you for our Independence Day and our No King's Day.
Well,
And maybe you'll come back.
absolutely, absolutely.
You could.
Shoshana, first, I'm proud of being, a member of our noble profession of arms, a trigger puller. But I'll say, when you need a trigger puller, you really need a trigger puller. But we can thank God that we're not a nation of just trigger pullers, right? We're a
Fair.
great nation because we have people from all walks of life trying to pull in the right direction. But let me close with, something about our Independence Day specifically. So in 2006, on July 4th, when I returned to my safe house in Iraqi Kurdistan after a mission, I come back and lo and behold, there's a gigantic bouquet of flowers that had been delivered to our safe house. Kurds love flowers. So who sent us flowers? Well, it was the minister of Peshmerga, a wonderful gentleman named Sheikh Jaffer. Sheikh Jaffer was a line-level fighter. He's respected on both sides of the Kurdish political spectrum. Everybody loves this guy. And it was a card that said, congratulations on your Independence Day. So I jumped, I grabbed my stuff. I jumped in a vehicle. I headed over to his headquarters. And I said, Sheikh Jaffer, I want to thank you for the wonderful bouquet. However, today is a great day. Our Independence Day is a great day to remember some of the very important joint interests shared by Kurds and Americans. For example, we both fought the British.
There you go. I like it. That's good. Did he appreciate that?
Oh, he loved it. Yeah, he loved it.
Great.
He knew exactly what I was talking about.
Great. Well, we have come to the end of our time, and we ended on a high note, I think. Ladies and gentlemen out there, we are off next week, so keep an eye on your mailbox, and we will inform you of the next Jewish Policy Center webinar. Enjoy your Independence Day. And again, Ernie, thank you very much. I've learned an unbelievable amount today, and I thank you.
Thank you, Shoshana.